You are listening to CEO Minutes, brought to you by Offutt Kerman, attorneys at law, your perfect legal partner.
Hi, my name is Jim Caruso. I'm the CEO and general partner of Flying Dog Brewery here in Frederick, Maryland. So Flying Dog started as a brew pub in Aspen, Colorado in 1990 over on Cooper Avenue, founded by George Stranahan, a true Renaissance man. His grandfather invented the Champion spark plug, also the AC Delco spark plug, sold them directly to Henry Ford and Alfred Sloan. George has a PhD in physics. He was head of the physics department at Michigan State University. He's founded three progressive schools that are still in existence today. He's a professional photographer, a writer, he had a music studio. He created the Woody Creek Tavern by converting the old post office in Woody Creek to what has become an institution there that everybody has to visit. And in the late 1980s, George was protecting the land in Woody Creek from some of the development that took place in Aspen, and was buying that up through some different parties, and bought what is now Owl Farm. Hunter S. Thompson had been in Aspen, Colorado. He had just finished his book that was written when he had embedded himself with the Hells Angels. And George invited him to rent that property. And Hunter did. He lived there from 1968 until his death in 2005. And in 1990, George created the Flying Dog Brew Pub, did some renovation on it. The name Flying Dog comes from a trip that George took to climb K2 with his teenage daughter and some other innocent people. No technical climbing experience. They even had a flag day called the March of the Innocents. K2, if people aren't aware, is the most dangerous mountain in the world. Its nickname is the Savage Mountain. It's the only major mountain that has never been a name. The K2 is the surveyor's name for it. It's in the Karakoram Range, K1, K2. It's so remote, it's never even been climbed in the winter. So George heads to Rawalpindi, Pakistan, finds some unsuspecting Sherpas to guide them up. On day 17, they run out of alcohol, and these are some pretty serious druggies and drinkers back then. On this journey was the famous economist Lester Thoreau and some other individuals. They make it back to Rawalpindi 32 days later, and they're exhausted, oxygen-deprived, alcohol-deprived. Much to their dismay, they realize it's a dry country, and George had to seek out an attorney so that he could file an affidavit declaring that his father was a Christian. They didn't care what his mother was, so they could get some nourishment and some alcohol. And in the room is this beautiful painting, not a like paint by numbers, of a dog in a position that you never see a dog in. Almost like Superman, with its four legs extended, its ears brushed back, kind of an English Spaniel, its legs tucked underneath it. And they couldn't figure it out. And they finally decided that a local artist must have misinterpreted the concept of English bird dog, because the British had been in that area during the Raj for many years. So this local artist thought bird dog, a dog can fly, so they named it the Flying Dog. The first time in the English language those two words were put together. So when George went back to Woody Creek, he started renaming everything Flying Dog, including his ranch, which used to be called the Lower Collins Creek Coyote Preserve. And he renamed it Flying Dog, and he had these hats. And his neighbors said, George, this is brilliant. That's such a great name. Can we have one of those hats? Named his music studio Flying Dog Music Studio. So when he opened Flying Dog Brew Pub so that the locals could have a hamburger that cost less than $40, he had to name it the Flying Dog Brew Pub. So Ralph Steadman, as I mentioned, Hunter had been renting Owl Farm from 1968. Ralph Steadman did original art for Hunter beginning in 1970. Hunter wanted to write a story about the Kentucky Derby. He grew up in Louisville. He was a juvenile delinquent. And he was always a little bit put off the fact that his rich friends would get off, you know, with crimes, and he would always, you know, find himself in trouble. And he knew that the Kentucky Derby behind the scenes was truly decadent and depraved. So he wanted to write an article exposing these people in their nice blue suits and white shoes who might have been puking all over themselves by the end of the day. And he said, I need a really special artist, somebody with a serious kink in his brain. And Warren Hinkle, who was the editor of Scanlon's magazine, this is who Hunter was writing for, went out of business right after that, said, I have just the guy, Ralph Steadman. He's illustrating for Private Eye right now. He'll be in America. He's perfect. So they met up. The rest is history. Shortly thereafter, he illustrated Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, very, very famous images, all of the Rolling Stone years, and that sort of stuff. And we sort of knew Ralph. You know, he would come to Woody Creek to visit Hunter. And we asked Hunter if he would ask Ralph if he would do some art for us, some original art. We viewed beer as liquid art in a bottle, and we wanted to have original art on the labels. And we got the Road Dog label and the Doggy Style Pale Ale label back. And they were on transparencies back then, not the digital files. And we just cracked up. It was just so funny. And the rest is history. Ralph these days does, I think he's on his 60th book. He's illustrated hundreds. He's won just about every award that's out there. I think he's got a new book coming out. We just had a fantastic birthday party for him at his local pub, Checkers. A little interesting story behind Checkers. It's spelled C-H-E-Q-U-E-R-S, Checkers with a Q. And I'd mentioned to some people here that I'm having Ralph's birthday party at Checkers. And so this happens to me all the time, and I wonder what else is out there. Months go by, and somebody said, I still don't understand why you're having Ralph's party at Checkers, as if it's a Checkers drive-in. I love Checkers drive-in, but just one of those funny miscommunications. It's actually a pub from the 1700s.
Was it Nixon's dog?
It was also Nixon's dog, yes. Excellent.
So Ralph still does artwork for his fine books?
Yes, so these days Ralph does his own books. I haven't counted them up. He's probably on his 50th label. We just received a new one from him. Actually, it's for the beer that we're doing in conjunction with the National Museum for Civil War Medicine, in conjunction with the Mercy Street series, because they were advisors to it. Hugely successful. The first one was called Sawbones. The next one is Dragon Lady. And then we'll probably have four or five more labels for Ralph this year. He rarely does exhibitions. He did one 3 years ago that we helped sponsor right next to the, near the London School of Economics. This year, the Society of Illustrators in New York City will have 150 of his original works. From there, it looks like it's going to Art Basel. He's brilliant. He is a true artist in the sense that if you go to Ralph and say, Ralph, I would like this, you know, I would like it just like this, he would say, well, it seems like you know just what you want. Why don't you have somebody draw it for you? Ralph likes to be as surprised by the end result as we are. And we're like little kids at Christmas when we get it. You open up the file and it's just delights and shocks us and it's interesting. And Ralph is such a good person. His art is so crazy. But I asked him one time, Ralph, what are your dreams like? He said, I don't really dream. Everything's like out on paper for the day. But he hates bullies. He hates injustice. He hates the atrocities of war. And Jan Wenner, the founder of Rolling Stone, as you may know if you've seen the movie For No Good Reason, a 50-year retrospective on his life that took 15 years to make, as bold and courageous as Hunter was, emotionally and mentally, Jan said that Ralph is way out there past Hunter in terms of what he's willing to commit to on paper and the points he makes with his art and his symbolism.
And once you talked about, let's transition to your involvement, mm-hmm. Once you were mentioning the 2000 transaction with WinCoop, mm-hmm. Was that the beginning of your involvement? Yeah, let's walk through your involvement with the company. Give us a little history of
sure. Transition to your involvement. I don't really do a lot of biographical talks or stuff like that. My background's economics, undergraduate and graduate. Had a nice long run as president of a public company. And then in the mid-90s, I was very fortunate to hook up with John Hickenlooper, who had founded the WinCoop Brewing Company, core urban area of Denver, which is truly my love, these core urban areas, getting life and energy back into it. I think the original rent on it was $1. Four stories, it was pretty much a blighted area, became the largest brew pub in the world. John wanted to expand that, so he and I created a new partnership. We had historic buildings, the Green train station in Green Bay, the original car dealership in Des Moines, Iowa, the theater in Omaha, these beautiful buildings, and our solution was to convert them to brew pubs, beautiful copper tanks, kind of reintroducing the high-end pool hall and pool room billiard parlor to America, banquet facilities, comedy spaces when possible. So we expanded those. And in 1994, a partnership was formed between that company and Flying Dog to manufacture and bottle beer. In the brew pubs, it was pints of beer over the bar. So this was a manufacturing facility. It was in the old Silver State Laundry in Denver. And we were in that building from 1994 until 1990, and until 1994 until 2000. And then we moved to another facility across the street, a real brewery, began outgrowing that. And by 2004, between transportation costs and fuel prices and our growth across the US, but especially on the East Coast, we were looking for more capacity. And we came across this beautiful facility that we're in today. It was the Frederick Brewing Company. We purchased it, moved all production, and we purchased it in May of 2006. And we moved all of our production out here January 1st of 2008. The only brewery to relocate itself across the country and go from this international strategy, a mile wide and an inch deep, being in 48 states and 23 countries, which was ludicrous for a brewery our size. And we concentrated all our efforts to become what we wanted to be, that is a valued member of the community, a trusted regional brand, and that's worked out very well for us.
There was a quote in one of the interviews that you said, Flying Dog, as you know it today, is very much a Maryland experience. Can you repeat that statement and just add that context?
So, as I mentioned, you know, the Flying Dog brew pub started in Aspen. We had the brewery in Colorado, in terms of the Flying Dog that you see today, this facility, the partnerships with the Oyster Recovery Project, the partnerships with the True Blue Crab Program, Otterbein's Cookies, Paul Reed Smith Guitars, our presence at the Orioles and the Ravens, our in-depth involvement in the Frederick community with the Weinberg Speaker Series, the Weinberg Flying Dog Movie Series. Last night was Leon the Professional on the big screen, fantastic. The Arts Council, everything that we, the National Museum of Civil War Medicine, this Flying Dog, as you know it today, we not only have produced and sold by far more beer here than we ever did in Colorado. So even though Colorado is our metaphysical center, the brand as you know it today is very much a Maryland experience. Even to the extent that the Washington Post named Dead Rise the most Maryland beer ever. Extremely proud of that.
So in conjunction of all the collaborations that you work with on local businesses, you've also sort of launched an amphitheater. Has the business really evolved and iterated to a more, tell me where the business is today and where your vision for this business. You're in your 25th year of doing this stuff. And it looks like you've been pivoting, pirouetting, and iterating from day one. Mm-hmm. Where are you today and where is this business 5 years from today?
So yeah, where we are today and where we were, it took a lot of, we fell in a lot of potholes over the last 20 years. There were a lot of potholes between then to here. So it was a very interesting journey. We learned a lot. You know, you have to consider back in the 1990s, nobody really knew much about the industry. You were very much figuring out as you went. Today, we pride ourselves on being as generous as we can with knowledge. We have Flying Dog University. We teach wholesalers and retailers and the outside public everything we can do to help educate them about beer. Brewery startups, we're happy to help, happy to advise them. But back then, it was learn as you go. So the next 25 years, now that we've established ourselves in Frederick, Maryland, and we are selling more than 70% of our beer, Maryland, D.C., Northern Virginia, we're expanding very thoughtfully and organically in the contiguous states, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York, to some extent, North Carolina and Ohio. So even though we still ship beer to 35, 38 states, and we have a very strong presence in both Western Europe, Eastern Europe, began shipping beer to China, this is our core. The difference being that out of the 45 beers, different styles of beer that we do every year, all of them are available here in Frederick, Maryland, Baltimore, Eastern Maryland. Outside of this area, we sell our three or four most popular styles. So it's still very much a local experience, even though we're shipping beer to some of these outlying markets. It's not the 45 styles of beer. Our goal isn't to be the biggest that we can, but it's to grow with the same principles that we have now, whether it's our commitment to music and the First Amendment and to our relationships. When we do partnerships, Otterbein's Cookies, for example, 100 years old or something, a very, very fine company, We went over there to learn about the cookie business. They came here to learn about the beer business. They did their first new cookie in 30 years to pair with our beer. So pairing beer and cookies is interesting. So it's not just that, oh, it'd be fun to have Flying Dog beers that pair with the cookies. We always learn a lot. So these partnerships are 1 + 1 = 3. The Oyster Recovery Project, we have one beer that's not vegetarian. We put meat into it. It's actually fresh oysters, Rappahannock. And even though we put oysters in that beer, there's a net benefit to the bay of 10 oysters. So for each bottle of Pearl Necklace oyster stout that we sell, we put about 10 oysters back into the bay. I would say over the last 6 years, we've put 11 to 12 million oysters back into the bay. We were out on the Chesapeake harvesting oysters. And I can't swim, so once you get onto water, I was a little bit nervous, but I'll take one for the team here. So whether it's crabs or oysters, we're actually out there seeing how the shells are rotated, how they're harvested. We learned what a dead rise boat is because we were out on one. So it's very much a learning and learning so that, you know, that's what's interesting in life. It's not just doing something at the edge, but it's expanding your knowledge and your horizons to really create interesting experiences for ourselves and for our consumers.
If we want to grab an image of the old bay summer ale.
Oh, yeah.
Might be a bottle back here. Here's Dead Rise here. This is Dead Rise, and the Dead Rise refers to the rise of the boat out of the water. It's a very, very shallow boat. And this, I think this too reflects that we're artisans, that, you know, we live and breathe to create. We are very much proponents and advocates of freedom of expression and freedom of speech. We pride ourselves on our innovation and resourcefulness. And we happen to make beer. We're also world-class brewers. And we'll probably do that for the next 1,000 years. But it's that artisanal nature to what we do and that freedom of expression and freedom of speech. It's not just at one level where we don't want to be, you know, that we object to authoritarianism and thought control. But that freedom of expression is people's very sense of humanity. That's why when it comes to creating beers, there are some breweries out there. There's one brewer that can create a beer. It's that person. Doesn't want any other ideas. It's one way to do it. We open it up to everybody. It used to be the Tea Room at Gambrill State Park. I think it's our 8th year. We outgrew that, so it's now Thorpewood. And everybody here has 2 minutes to make a pitch for a beer. You can make multiple pitches. At 60 or 70, I would have done them all, but we have to narrow it down to 8. It's our brewhouse rarities. But that interaction where people who are in the office experience get to connect with a brewer, actually create a beer, really have an on-hands understanding of it is very true to our, I guess, our DNA, which is as artisans.
Let's walk through, I mean, at lunch we're talking about, you know, your close, First Amendment close encounters or potholes. Mm-hmm. Can you just walk us through, I mean, you've sort of an interesting history starting in Denver and then mm-hmm. Is it Minnesota, and just to walk us through mm-hmm. Offensive and vulgar brands.
Before you start, please put the bottle back just so there's continuity.
Sure. Yeah,
are you getting the Harry A bottle too?
Oh, sorry about that. Harry Pellegrino,
yeah. Grand cross promotion. Just walk us through those.
On the ground next to
me. Oh, sure.
The challenges you faced in terms of branding, First Amendment issues.
So freedom of speech, if you say freedom of speech in breweries, the Flying Dog name will come up. And it comes from, I guess, the source of this, whether it's George Stranahan and his entrepreneurial independent spirit, you know, up there in Colorado, our, you know, connection with Hunter S. Thompson, you know, my maternal grandparents leaving Russia after the Troubles and before the Revolution. We are very, very much proponents, believers in, and advocates and make real the concept of personal and individual freedom, economic freedom and opportunity for people. This is who we are. And whenever you see constraints on that, we object to that. And freedom of speech does come up in this industry because both the federal government and the state liquor commissions have to approve beer labels. And there's been this interesting phenomenon. There was something called Prohibition, which would have made this not possible. And the 21st Amendment repealed Prohibition. and it gave states at that time the right to control alcohol. Well, there was this dynamic that I think came into play that states thought that somehow that meant they were immune from the First Amendment. The First Amendment did apply. It could control the beer and the labels. So there's been an ongoing, interesting relationship between breweries, distilleries, wineries, appointed officials on liquor commissions across the country, from time to time rejecting labels because they didn't like the label, they had a personal agenda, they might have been extremely squeamish for reasons that had nothing to do with constitutional freedoms. And we had a couple of run-ins. Ralph's art is edgy, for sure, but under no definition is it obscene or banned language, and it's not hateful. In fact, similar to Ralph, I am the most anti-bully person that I know. I mean, I object to anything. We would never do stuff that offensive, but edgy and fun is different from offensive. So the first label that we received from Ralph had the saying, good beer, no shit on it, which related to an essay that Hunter wrote for the release of Road Dog. And we hand, each bottle had a little necker on it with this essay with Hunter, and it was interesting essay, and it finished with this ancient Celtic axiom, et cetera, good people drink good beer. So Ralph put good beer, no shit on the label saying, my friend Hunter wrote this essay, and of course good people drink good beer. And, you know, the Colorado Liquor Commission rejected it. ACLU took that to the Colorado Supreme Court. It was an administrative decision, and we won. They overruled the Liquor Commission. We didn't do that because, you know, we just were against authority for authority's sakes. It was wrong. It was a crime against freedom of speech that corporations are entitled to. And it was art that was being banned. It's 2000, of course, it was 1995 back then, but it's still modern times. And then we had a run-in with Michigan, who banned the Raging Bitch label. This was a bigger deal. And that was a situation where Michigan, again, appointed officials that, as regulators, often have the belief that they can enact laws without referendums or people voting on them, take political correctness to an extreme. And political correctness in that regard is just a way to get people to stop talking about stuff and control their thoughts, and you can't talk about this. And they rejected our label for some pretty ludicrous reasons. We sued the commissioners as individuals in federal court, the Western District. The opinion was not in our favor. The opinion was they may or may not have violated your First Amendment rights, but they're immune from prosecution, even if they did, because they're regulators. And that, of course, we didn't believe was true. We appealed at the Federal Court of Appeals level and 6th District, and the decision was unanimously in our favor that yes, you can sue them. They're not immune from prosecution. And the minority opinion went so far as to say, and this was a clear violation of Flying Dog's First Amendment right to freedom of speech and expression. Go back to Michigan and figure out what the damages were. Michigan settled up quickly, and we moved on. We took the proceeds from that, the damages, and created the First Amendment Society. Because, again, this had nothing to do with publicity or one style of beer in one state that's even a little bit off of our radar. It was about what might seem like petty tyranny in a beer label, but it's really about constitutional freedoms, and those are being chipped away at. The cover of the Economist magazine 2 weeks ago, was freedom of speech under attack. And we see that over and over again. So we created the First Amendment Society. It's separate from Flying Dog, but we funded it to start with. And it's so that we can have some residual benefit from this experience in Michigan and continue that conversation. We have a banned book club. It's a partnership with the Frederick County Public Library. Last month, we had our first speaker here, a law professor from the University of Baltimore, who spoke about Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass. Walt Whitman got fired for having that book on his desk, fired from a government agency. And it was a brilliant conversation. And Professor Epps actually talked about the poetry of the Constitution. Again, this is where that sense of humanity comes into it for us. This month's banned book is Harry Potter. And we'll have a professor talking about why Harry Potter is the most banned book in America. In August, we have Ron Collins, a First Amendment law professor from the University of Washington, talking about Howl by Allen Ginsberg. We're also working with the University of Maryland to create a scholarship for investigative journalism. It's kind of a lost art these days. A lot of newspapers are just taking press releases and, you know, putting them out there. We are really cementing our relationship with Jeff Herbst and the folks over at the Newseum and their First Amendment Center. So we have, we're supporting Can't You Take a Joke? Can't We Take a Joke? It's Greg Lukianoff and FIRE, the organization that really fights, yeah, some noise up there. It's in conjunction with, yeah, we can get them to just hold off on that. If you could get somebody's attention back there and ask them if they could just hold off.
Kegs?
No, we do. We have pallets moving back and forth, pallet jacks moving back and forth. So Kristen or somebody will, we'll stop that. Anybody there? Somebody there. Oh, maybe they stopped. So the so at the Newseum, between the First Amendment Center and some events that we're doing there, our support of the release of Greg Lukianoff's movie, the FIRE organization that fights. Could you have them just hold off on that for about a half an hour? Thanks. There's a second floor up here. We have tons of packaging materials. It's a brewery. It's a brewery. It's a brewery.
They're going out, so can we call you Tommy Lee Jones?
Okay, yeah.
Tommy Lee Jones?
All the time. All the time. All the time. I see the similarity. I have this rough skin and so forth. I do the, about every 2 years, I do the Stockholm Beer and Whiskey Festival. And you'd be surprised how many people have flying dog tattoos. I mean, it's amazing. It brings tears to my eyes. But these three young women would not believe that I was not Tommy Lee Jones. So I finally said, you're right. I'm a pitch man for flying dog. I'm just a pitch man for flying dog. So as I was saying, the First Amendment Society, like everything we do, we put it out there, then we make it better and better and better. But our relationship with the stuff we're doing here with Frederick County Public Library, the Newseum, this will continue that dialogue. And we'll have lots of fun with it, too. We want to have young people especially appreciate in a very interactive way what some of these constitutional freedoms are.
At lunch, you talked about fervor of activity in terms of microbrew, and everyone's getting it. You've got private equity getting this. Can you give us sort of an overview? You guys started this business to a certain extent, you know, and now everyone's sort of jumping in, private equity's jumping in. Can you give us some historical
and the
overview?
And the metrics, how many were at every point,
So yeah, so this craft beer industry is relatively new. Most breweries disappeared after Prohibition. Was very consolidated, and Jimmy Carter signed a law making home brewing legal, and that led to this craft beer industry. Some of the forerunners were Fritz Maytag from the Maytag fortune. He bought the old Anchor Brewing Company in San Francisco. I think he dropped out of Stanford to do that, and he did that from 1968 until about 2010. Friends of mine like Jim Cook from Sam Adams, who started in the mid-80s, Ken Grossman, started Sierra Nevada. And then in the late 80s, early 90s, it really started to take off. When we started, there were approximately 100 breweries in America. And we knew everybody. It was a very small industry. The Great American Beer Festival was like, you could fit it into this room here. Now 40,000 people go. There are now, so there's about 100 today, this year. Nobody even knows because you can't even keep track. There are probably 4,700 breweries. And the statistics for the last 2 years were that three breweries opened per day for the last 2 years. So in a period of 30 days, more breweries are opening than even existed 25 years from now. It's a booming industry. Craft beer industry is growing at 10 to 14% a year. It's great to be one of those pioneer breweries, if you're still here. Well, one of the bankers told me one time when I was trying to borrow some money was, I said, we're pioneers in the industry. Puts his big cowboy boots up on the desk. Leans back and he goes, let me tell you, son, the pioneers get the arrows, the settlers get the land. It was my first time I heard that expression. So I I didn't use Pioneer for a while, it's a fantastic industry. I don't know what our ranking is, probably 37. It's not an important number to me. But there's a group of breweries. So the largest would be Sam Adams, a very, very fine brewery. Jim Cook, who founded that in the 80s. They're probably 20 or 25 times our size. And then Sierra Nevada, a very, very fine brewery. Tremendous respect for Ken Grossman and what he's achieved. There's a big group of us like Dogfish Head and Flying Dog that are in that relevant range. And then it's a pretty long tail in this industry, as you can imagine. So those 4,500 breweries, including nano breweries that brew like one barrel of beer and sell it to their local bar. And I love those guys. I love them all, yeah.
So yeah, give us the Sam Adams, an incredible success.
Yeah.
What did they do right?
Basically everything. Jim Cook's a genius. He has like 10 PhDs or something. I don't know. He's Harvard MBA, and he was with the Boston Consulting Group. So he really drew tremendous attention to the industry. It's the only craft brewery that's a public company. And I'm not sure we'd be where we are today if he didn't do so much to promote the industry. So the growth these days is, you know, it used to be we put in equity, our own money, and grew. And some of us still that. We're still a very closely held private company. Others are expanding. As with any industry that seems to be growing, it can attract a lot of cash. It can be the next get-rich-quick scheme. You know, how hard can that be? It's like when I was in the bar business, and people say, I just want to retire and get a bar. I'm like, it's the last thing you want to do if you want to retire. So behind the scenes, it's always sausage making, and so is the brewing industry, and it's quite complex. We all have, many of us here have degrees in brewing science. It's a complicated industry, and the market's unforgiving. You know, back in the 90s, consistency was a distinctive feature for your beer. Here, if you can't have consistent beer that's shelf-stable, you're not even in the business. So the expansion these days has partly been from some private equity, equity coming into the business, possibly, you know, in some cases for the wrong reason, putting out questionable beer. And what bothers many of us in the industry about that is they say, it's you know, it's statistics, but maybe half of the beer drinkers in America haven't actually tried craft beer yet. And when you look at the tap handles that I'm looking at now, 20 tap handles, the names and the beer styles, overwhelming. You know, that you, if it's somebody's first experience into craft, you don't want them drinking, not a beer that I don't like, but an infected beer, going, I can't, all this talk about craft beer, stuff's undrinkable. So the Brewers Association, the National Brewers Association, the State Brewers Associations, brewers like us are doing everything possible to help educate people coming into the industry, the brewers themselves, the general public. We do a lot of beer tastings. We want the industry to grow. So the private equity that's coming into it, I think that private equity is excellent. I would caution people that take funds from private equity to have an attorney who specializes in that. Read the fine print, read the covenants, and know what you're getting into. We have not taken any private equity into Flying Dog. We don't intend to. We do traditional financing and personal equity. Different models, different programs, but just, you know, be aware of what you're getting into, especially with the flood of money coming into the industry.
The more you were telling me this story, I can't help but think that this, and I didn't do a lot of homework on Coors, but you seem to be an alternative to your Colorado company, and Coors had some very myopic, if not some limited view of the world. It seems like you've built a company that's the anti-Coors. I don't know if you can frame that.
So,
off base, but it seems, yeah.
Yeah. So I said craft brewers. Well, what else is there? Well, there's the large domestic breweries. Anheuser-Busch, the largest brewery in the world, used to be based in St. Louis. They're based in Brazil. Coors Brewing Company. Molson Coors, and there's some others, Heineken and so forth. These are international massive brewers. I don't even know the size of Anheuser-Busch with all their affiliates. They're probably 3,000 times our size. Huge, huge companies. Coors, on the other hand, they were our neighbors in Colorado. We like the Coors family. They're great, great people. They used to distribute our beer. Pete Coors is a tremendous spokesman for the industry. Coors Banquet beer is a fantastic beer. But it's different. The American lager is different from what we do. And when you look at breweries like Heineken, still family-owned, Coors, still very much family-controlled, we respect them. They're good for the industry. When you look at well, I'm not the Department of Justice, but the Department of Justice taking a close look at the Anheuser-Busch as they continue to acquire breweries, including South African breweries, South African Brewery Miller, their tremendous penetration and clout in terms of distribution. It's a reason to be cautious that consumers won't have less and less choice because they're simply squeezed out of the market, both on the shelf and through distribution. That's the Anheuser-Busch scenario. Coors, Heineken, they're just bigger breweries than we are. And as a free market person, I have no objection to large companies. I don't want them restricted. I don't want them regulated. As long as we're all playing by the same rules, it's great. I do object to corporate welfare and regulations that favor giant corporations at the expense of small corporations. But other than that, saying get as big as you want.
So there's big companies spend a ton of money on advertising. Mm-hmm. And how do you compete? I mean, you've got all these brands that you've got to manage. You know, mm-hmm. How do you compete with the scale and the branding that they have, and you've got all these separate brands?
It's an interesting question about how do you compete these days. We have always competed in the way that actually the world has come around and actually fits with the way we compete. So these days, if you run ads, if you do a Super Bowl ad, 50% of the people afterwards they love the ad, but they can't tell you if it was Coors or Budweiser, you know, and they cost millions of dollars. They do these studies. So we have never believed that, you know, just going out there with radio, print, and TV was the way to go. That the way the world is changing, that businesses like ours grow via word of mouth. That if you run ads and you're our size, it says, well, we have enough money to run ads. It doesn't. You kind of get lost in the shuffle. So what we do is we do things that are remarkable. And by remarkable, what I mean is it's worth remarking about the next day. Whether it's the Violent Femmes concert, or somebody went on a tour and learned that we put 11 million oysters back into the bay, or some of the fun stuff like we do, like Welcome and Who's Not Welcome Here, and Paul Reed Smith guitars, and the True Blue Project. All of that helps us continue to do things that the community appreciates and admires, and that is our goal. So it's through word of mouth that we advertise. I don't know how many beers were introduced last year into the market. I'll say 300,000. You figure if there are 4,500 breweries, we introduced 13 or 14 on our own. So I saw a statistic last year, I think in March or April, that after the first trimester, the TTB, the federal agency that approves labels, had something like 80,000 labels to sign off on. I mean, it makes sense when you have 5,000 breweries each doing 10, 12, 15 new beers per year. So in that regard, I think that some of that works in our benefit, because when you go to a liquor store, they say that only 10% of the people are unsure of what they want. And you know, if somebody were to pick a beer at random, I can't even find Flying Dog sometimes, and it's extremely distinctive. So having that top of mind awareness, or that remember, oh yeah, Flying Dog. I went to their Leon the Professional, the movie series. You know, I'll try a Flying Dog. So, and you can be assured that it's going to be world class, consistently high quality. And if you're shelling out $10-$12 of your hard earned money, that's our obligation to make sure that beer is consistent and it is world class, and that you're not being misled in any way.
So you recently made a commitment to the Frederick era. You purchased 32 acres. Can you tell us about that acquisition and the role that Offutt Kermit mm-hmm. played?
So we've been growing, you know, from the brew pub to our first brewery, to our second brewery in Denver, to this facility, and we're outgrowing this. So we do have 32 acres of land under contract in the city of Frederick, next to the airport, and that's where we like to be. It's not that hard to go out in the middle of the country and do a brewery. It's more complex, you have more neighbors, more regulations, but that's where we want to be, in the heart of the city. This brewery, I think we had about 50,000 people visit us on tours and for other events from outside of Frederick, and then go to downtown Frederick to enjoy the bars and the restaurants. So as we see an opportunity to grow, we wanted to stay in Frederick, and when this opportunity became available within the city limits, it was perfect for us. We put it under contract, and it's an extremely complex deal. We're next to the FAA. We have city regulations to work with, you know, things that we want to do on this property with entertainment and music. And Bob Kresslein and Offutt Kermit have been instrumental, not only in early on, when Bob Kresslein worked with us to get the legislation in place that allowed us to serve a sample of beer to somebody who might come all the way from Amsterdam. And prior to this legislation, we'd have to tell them, no, I'm sorry, it's prohibited by law. Now we can have people come in there, give them samples of beer, and Bob and his many hours that he spent working on that resulted in legislation that makes this experience possible. Worked with us to acquire the building, which went very well. And now the big project is working in conjunction with the city, who have been extremely amenable. We all want to make it happen, but it's complex. There are legislation, it's FAA regulations, a lot of zoning and stuff like that. And again, Bob Kresslein and Offutt Kerman have been invaluable, instrumental, and fun to work with. And you could tell we like to have a little bit of fun here. So, and Bob enjoys our beer, so it was just a match made in heaven from the start. I actually met Bob when he was walking in, and he was coming to get a beer or something. I said, by the way, do you do real estate stuff? He goes, absolutely. And so it's been just a fantastic partnership ever since. And Bob has helped us in many areas, so there are many areas of expertise in Offutt Kerman that we've benefited from through our relationship.
You have a new beer coming out called Kresslein.
The Kresslein beer, yes. And Bob's grandfather was a brewer with Monumental Brewing Company. So there's that DNA that we both share. We have this beer in our veins.
Can you do a pitch for Snake Dog?
I can do a pitch for Snake Dog. So often I'm asked, so what is your favorite beer? Well, if the beer is being sold by Flying Dog, we love it here. Certainly the brewing team, us, we love the beer. And all of our babies are beautiful. But I have to say that since 1997, since we've been brewing Snake Dog, if I'm at the brewery, at the end of the day, I have a glass of Snake Dog. It's an IPA. It's an edgy IPA. It's a little bit extreme and edgy, distinctive. And at the end of the day, I have a glass of Snake Dog. It makes the world right. And I'll sample some of the other beers for quality control purposes.
So this is my hardest hitting question. So
yeah.
Am I really
Tommy Lee Jones? I do see the similarity, the rough skin, and I think we're the same age and all that sort of stuff. I am not Tommy Lee Jones, though there are three women in Sweden from the Stockholm Beer and Whiskey Festival that to this day think that Tommy Lee Jones, they would not believe me that I wasn't, so I finally said that I was, and that I'm now a pitch man for Flying Dog Brewery.
That segment's for me.
Okay. So of the 45 beers that you have, and mm-hmm.
So when we talk about the artisanal nature of craft breweries, you know, all these beers, I mentioned we have 45 beer styles, 45 different styles of beer. That's quite complex. And those 45 beers actually go into 400 different packages, 5-gallon kegs, half barrels, 12 packs, variety packs, all that sort of stuff. It's a European labels, very, very complex. So with those beers, at any one time, we'll probably have, like right now, I think we have 20 beers available. We have 12 or 14 that are available year-round. Then we have our seasonal beers. Then we have our brewhouse rarities, one every 6 weeks throughout the year. That comes from the exercise and the what's become probably the most fun event at Flying Dog, the brewer pitch session. Then we have limited releases. So winter beers, a coffee stout, or a barley wine, which in the old days, beer is made with barley, wine is made with grapes, it's a vinous spirit, but we high alcohol beers were called wine, so they were made with barley but called wine. And then we have our heat series. So we have been experimenting with habanero and other ancho, so we decided to do a series of beer that have a lot of heat to it. And it gets hotter and hotter. The last one that we're doing is with the Carolina Reaper, the ghost pepper, a million times hotter than Tabasco. We actually went down to Charlotte where the guy who created this pepper is, and it's going to be off the chart. We had a little sample of it in here, opened it, and people 20 feet away were already starting to experience the effects of it. So it comes out throughout the year. At any one time, I said we have about 15 or 20 beers. About four or five are available outside of our home territory. All of the beers are available here. A few of them, like our Sub Rosa series, is available only here. Sub Rosa is Latin. I think there's some attorneys present. They probably studied Latin. Sub is under, Rosa is rose. And the rose was the symbol of secrecy back in the day. So sub rosa meant in secret, under the rose. And we have a pilot brew system, and we do some very secret experimental stuff that's only available here in the tasting room.
That's not the open source beer.
We do have an open source, but we did an open source project, and we may do that again. We opened it up to everybody, open source, to come in with ideas, and we brewed a beer that was a collaboration of brewers' input and home brewers' input from across the country.
Awesome. Tim, talk a little bit about the importance of trademarking your brands and your labels, how that fits into your whole business model.
Yeah, so people sometimes wonder, with all these beers, these hundreds of thousands of beers out there, how do you find a name? Well, it's challenging. If you go to find a name for a beer, especially if it has the name Dog in it, I can guarantee you it's probably taken. Raging Bitch, the beer that has become the First Amendment beer, started out as Double Dog. We use El Diablo yeast. It's a raging yeast. That's actually where the name Raging comes from in Raging Bitch. It's a very aggressive yeast that ferments very aggressively. As soon as you type in Double Dog, and by the way, in Raging Bitch, El Diablo yeast, a raging yeast, bitch is a dog. Raging Bitch, we get it, has other connotations. It was our number one seller from the month we introduced it until today, and women across the board, including every lady who works at Flying Dog. That's the reason we did that. It was our 20th anniversary. Got a little off track here, but I'll tell you the Raging Bitch story real quick. So our 20th anniversary, couldn't come up with a name, came up with the name Raging Bitch. It was my 26-year-old marketing person, and I said, we're not getting up. This name has to get in. It takes about 11 months to have this whole process happen. And we came up with Raging Bitch, a raging yeast, bitch is a dog. And she said, I love it, but I have to ask my mom. She came back the next day and said, my mom loves it. And so I came back to the brewery. We had all the ladies from Flying Dog in the conference room. I said, it's our 20th anniversary. We have several names for the beer, one of which is Raging Bitch. And they all loved it. And Heather said to me, based on everything you say about we do what's true for us and so forth, if you don't do that, I'll be forever disappointed in you. And the beer has really caught on. It's many women find it a very empowering name. But when you go back to the name thing, when you start Googling names, especially if it has the name Dog in it, it's taken, it's taken, it's taken. So there is a lot, there's been more and more conflict in the industry on trademark and copywriting, that sort of thing. So it is an art, and something that we hadn't done for many years is now a big workload for us in terms of getting these beers trademarked. We sell beer across the world, so we have European trademark situations, China. Somebody I'm sure can read the documents, I can't, but supposedly we have some protection there. It's a big deal. We had if you Google dogfight, Flying Dog Brewery versus Budweiser, in 2000, well, for many years, Budweiser has a brand of beers out there, the Wild Series, Wild Red, Wild Blue, Wild Black. They're beers that we would never do. I'm not saying they're bad beers. They're just beers with flavorings in them that would never be Flying Dog. The art is very similar to Flying Dog's art. The copy on it is very similar. Nowhere does it say made by Budweiser. On the bottom of the package, it indicates a brewery. It shows up on the shelf next to our beer sometimes, and we get complaints from our consumers. It's kind of a big deal. We don't sue Budweiser. They're way too big. They would crush us. But, you know, that kind of blurriness and confusion in the market is not good for the industry. But it's a challenge, and copywriting has become critical. And that's as the industry changes. When you have 100 breweries and there aren't that many names out there, it's very different from 4,500 breweries, each introducing 10 or so beers per year.
This has been CEO Minutes, brought to you by Offit Kerman, attorneys at law, your perfect legal partner. For more information and to tell your entrepreneurial story, visit us on the web at ceominutes.com.